It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, our guest unmasks curry. Now, Lizzie Collingham says India's most popular curries each tell a different story of a significant outside influence. Really, it's how a world-class cuisine comes into being. Her book is Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Well, world-class grilled cheese sandwiches have the stern swooning at Clementine's in L.A. Wine Spectator's Matt Kramer takes us down the newest wine roads of California. Then it's a rite of passage, going to work with Dad, except that Dad's a star chef. And we have the newest edge in upscale cocktails. It tastes awful, but it's good for you. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's curry, the inside edition. Seriously, it's the story of a curry dish born out of a major shift in India's history. Our guest is Lizzie Collingham, author of Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Well, we have new wine roads to travel in California from wine critic Matt Kramer. It's Going to Work with Dad. Celebrity chef Charlie Palmer takes his two boys into the kitchen of his multi-starred restaurant. Then The Bitter Edge and Prom Dresses, the latest thing in the $20 cocktail. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, have you guys by any chance gotten to California lately?
As a matter of fact, we were there in April, and lucky us, April happens to be Grilled Cheese Month. Now, you may not have known this.
Not in all of California.
No, in the world, April is Grilled Cheese Month.
I didn't get the memo.
We didn't either. We didn't know this.
Are you making this up?
The Cheese Council so proclaimed it.
Oh, I see.
And we found this out only because we walked into this wonderful little bakery called Clementine, and to honor Grilled Cheese Month, they serve grilled cheese all month, a different kind of sandwich every single day of the month.
And when you walk in, they give you a passport that looks exactly like a USA passport, except it's green, not navy blue. And there's a stamp on each page of the passport for a different grilled cheese sandwich. And of course, if you come in, you get stamped every day. You know, Michael, I had no idea. I thought this was just something Clementine's invented. I didn't realize this was really.
No, this is a worldwide celebration that we've been unaware of up to this point.
I would say so.
But tell me about what the grilled cheese is like there.
Well, as I said, there's a different kind every day of the month. Some of them we're all familiar with. Like on April 11th, they made a Cuban sandwich, which we all know, that's the roast pork, the ham, the cheese, mustard, and mayonnaise on a length of Cuban bread.
Right.
And they actually had a Taylor ham sandwich from New Jersey, which amazed me that they would even know about it. You know, Taylor ham is that kind of ham that is unique to New Jersey.
What's it like?
Well, it's usually served at breakfast. It's vaguely similar to Canadian bacon.
Oh, yeah. It's like a piece of solid pork that's been cured like bacon. This
exactly.
is a New Jersey girl talking, by the way.
Okay, well, then so you know. So they had a Taylor ham sandwich
right.
one day. I mean, they had brie with sautéed spinach. They had a Monterey Jack grilled portobello mushrooms. They had a Coney Island cheese sandwich, which was a hot dog topped with chili and cheese. I mean, they ran the gamut from fancy to plain and plain to fancy.
So can I go in there now and get all that stuff, or do you have to wait for the specials or next year?
You cannot get 30 different grilled cheese sandwiches today.
You have to wait until next April.
I'm sure there is some grilled cheese on the menu. The really good news is, though, that Clementine has a full menu of terrific stuff. I mean, it's a bakery. They bake everything. The chef, Annie Millar, goes to the markets in the morning and gets her produce. So at lunch, you can have a simple roast beef sandwich that is anything but simple because it's on her bread with these wonderful marinated onions that she puts on the roast beef and her own horseradish mustard. That is a terrific sandwich.
And just so you know, Annie Millar's backstory is, I mean, here she's making grilled cheese sandwiches, but she's a graduate of the Cordon Bleu. She cooked at Spago in Beverly Hills at Campanile. I can never say that.
Oh, Campanile.
Thank you, Campanile and La Brea Bakery. I mean, she could be a hoity-toity chef, but she chooses not to be.
You can kind of taste that in some of the breakfast items. I, for example, think the corn cakes that are dotted with little bits of chopped orange at breakfast are a little bit fancy and totally wonderful.
Well, where is this in L.A.?
It's in Century City, kind of near Santa Monica Boulevard.
Do they do breakfast, lunch, and dinner too?
Breakfast, lunch. I'm not sure about dinner. It may just be breakfast and lunch, and a lot of people go there just to get baked goods. There are a few tables outside on the sidewalk, so you can sit in the open air and enjoy it. It's just a delightful, happy, comfortable place.
Well, who couldn't be happy with a homemade banana cream pie made with homemade graham crackers? I mean, which is also one of their specialties. Also, if you hold off and wait till next April to go here, April also happens to be National Poetry Month and National Grilled Cheese Month, or just Cheese Month.
I don't know.
So you're going to have poets reading as
well.
They
the restaurant had a grilled last cheese year. Haiku competition last year.
Only in L.A., I'm sorry. Grilled cheese and haiku, of course.
But grilled cheese, I have to say, Lynn, grilled cheese and tomato sandwich is on my all-time top 10 favorite list.
Oh, God.
Do you love grilled cheese?
I love grilled cheese.
Who doesn't?
Hey, guys, thanks.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Just got a grilled cheese. Got a grilled cheese. Got a grilled cheese.
Shane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org, and come do some local food like nowhere else with us. Now, in August, we are heading to Santa Fe. It's a music trip with food, and the food is New Mex-Mex, which makes Tex-Mex look like overkill. Our trip includes tickets to the Santa Fe Opera and the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and a dinner and a farmer's market tour with me. Now, I think the market tour alone is worth the trip. Anyway, check it out on the website, splendidtable.org. Wine critic Matt Kramer gave us a vacation idea. Now, Matt's columnist for Wine Spectator, and he's author of the book series Making Sense of Wine. Now, the latest one is Matt Kramer's New California Wine, Making Sense of Napa Valley, Sonoma, Central Coast, and Beyond. Well, the beyond part is what got to me. I mean, tracking wine routes in the territories that are just coming up would make a really swell holiday. Hey, Matt, welcome.
Wonderful to be here, Lynn.
Matt, you know, we all know about Napa and Sonoma and that there are new areas cropping up in California for wines. What, for you, are the big up-and-comers?
Well, one of the things that I discovered was that, indeed, there are whole worlds beyond Napa and Sonoma now, which wasn't true, in fairness, 15 years ago. For example, you've got in Santa Barbara County, that's north of Los Angeles. In Santa Barbara County, there are several zones, but the latest and greatest and the hottest and newest is called Santa Rita Hills. And the thing about Santa Rita Hills is that it's very cool because it gets the impact of ocean breezes, maritime air.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's fog in the morning during the summer that burns off at around 10 a.m. And it creates a magnificent climate for growing Pinot Noir. And as you know, because we've all seen sideways, Pinot Noir is the hot thing.
Right.
There are 24,000 acres of Pinot Noir in California today. That's as much as in all of Burgundy.
Wow. Okay.
And one of the newest areas is Santa Rita Hills. You have producers such as Sanford, Foley, Babcock, Fiddlehead, Melville, and probably a dozen more. Sea Smoke, wonderful name. And they are making intense, vibrant Pinot Noirs with beautiful acidity. And I have to tell you, in all fairness, that these wines are not necessarily cheap. They're going to set you back between $30 and $45 a bottle. But I will tell you, they will provide some of the most compelling Pinot Noir experiences you will get from a California wine.
Huh. Another area?
Another area certainly would be Mendocino County, which is north of Sonoma and Napa.
Oh, it's Mendocino way up there on the north coast, right?
It's right up there on the north coast, but it's always been not so much the black sheep as the forgotten first cousin sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that Mendocino County is now really coming into its own. For example, the finest sparkling wine made in California comes from Mendocino County. It comes from Roederer Estate. There's a very famous French champagne house called Louis Roederer, something like that. And, of course, in California, it becomes Roederer, and it's Roederer Estate. And they are in this tiny valley called Anderson Valley in Mendocino County that's very cool. At one end of it, you have towering redwoods. In fact, when you drive through, you have to put on your headlights. It's so dark because of all the redwoods. And Roederer Estate makes wonderful sparkling wine. I mean, really as good as many, many producers in the Champagne region of France. Very widely available. Sells for, typically $24.95 a bottle. It's wonderful stuff. And then there are producers that are very well known, such as Fetzer. Fetzer is the big powerhouse producer in Mendocino County, and they make very good Cabernet. But smaller names like Jepson, which makes some of the best Sauvignon Blanc in California from a tiny little place called Sanel Valley. Huh. Also, Hush, H-U-S-C-H, makes beautiful Sauvignon Blanc. Mm-hmm. A third area, Lynn, that really is coming on very strong is Paso Robles. Paso Robles literally means the pass of the oaks. And Paso Robles is almost exactly equidistant between Los Angeles to the south and San Francisco to the north. Mm-hmm. And the specialty of Paso Robles is Syrah. Now, you have to understand one thing about Syrah. Syrah is, in my opinion, going to be the next really big red. We're going to see lipstick shades called Syrah. We're going to see bed and breakfasts called Syrah. There'll be golf courses called Syrah. Don't laugh. This has already happened with Chardonnay and Cabernet and Pinot Noir.
You're right. Okay.
Syrah is going to be the next really big red. And the center point of the best Syrahs in California today is this town and zone called Paso Robles. And what's fascinating about Paso Robles is that it's really divided into two parts. There is a west side of Paso Robles, which is west of Highway 101, which runs north-south, and then there is the flat and warmer east side of Paso Robles. The west side of Paso Robles is hilly, and it feels the effect of the Pacific Ocean marine air coming in. It's probably about 20 miles as the seagull flies from Paso Robles west to the ocean. And on the west side of Paso Robles are some of the finest Syrahs being made in California today. You have producers like Dark Star Cellars, Saxum, Tobless Creek. There's even a Pinot Noir producer there, even though it's a fairly warm zone, mm-hmm. called Windward, that makes beautiful Pinot Noir because they are right where the marine air comes literally roaring in. The fascinating thing about the west side of Paso Robles is that the soil is very heavily chalky, which is very rare in California. And I remember when I was visiting there, they kept telling me about finding petrified whale bones in their vineyards.
Huh.
I saw this giant thing on somebody's desk, and I said, gee, that looks like a vertebrae. And he said, it is. It's a petrified whale vertebrae.
So we're talking calcium up the kazoo?
They have calcium all the way to Kalamazoo. The east side of Paso Robles is flatter, warmer, and frankly, more commercial. You've got a lot of big operations there. But there is one very, very good producer whose wines are spread all across America named J. Period Lore.
Oh, yes. L-O-H-R. You see them everywhere.
Well, Jerry Lore is a real man, and he has tremendous ambition. He must own about 1,400 acres of bearing vineyards on the east side of Paso Robles alone, and he makes a wonderful Syrah and a wonderful Cabernet Sauvignon. He has a famous brand called Seven Oaks. You can find it for $7.99, $8.99. Huh. And he has more expensive wines, which for him would be $20.
Huh. Hey, Matt, thanks for the tour.
You're most welcome, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.
Wine critic Matt Kramer is columnist for Wine Spectator, and he's author of Matt Kramer's New California Wine, Making Sense of Napa Valley, Sonoma, Central Coast, and Beyond. Now, for information on Matt's wine picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. Now, every week we send you a quick worknight recipe. Now, the goal is to make your worknight suppers a little easier. And best of all, weeknight kitchen's free. So sign up. splendidtable.org. Coming up, curry, an untold story, and bitter truths, prom dresses, and other barkeep confessions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. You know, if you look at the breadth and the sheer magnificence of Indian food, you have to wonder how it came about. Profound here is not an overstatement. So many religions, each eating differently, so many traditions, so many deeply regional styles and actual cuisines, and so many influences from the outside. Well, historian Lizzie Cullingham tackled the big question of how Indian food became what it is now, and she did it cleverly. She profiles the country's most ubiquitous food, curry, in its most famous guises. Her book is Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Hey, Lizzie, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be there.
You know, you talk about how foreign influence shaped so much of Indian food, but there was a great deal there to begin with, going back quite a few hundred years. What was the food in India like in the beginnings of the cuisine?
Well, it's a very ancient cuisine, as it's an ancient culture, and the earliest indications of what food were like come from medical texts, which describe the kinds of foods you should eat for different seasons, or if you live in a particular place, the kinds of foods you should eat to keep you in equilibrium with your environment. And they also told you how to adjust your diet to the seasons and so on. And so the physicians of the earliest times were really, their job was to be a proficient cook, not just somebody who doled out medicine. And in India, in the ancient period, you divided food into hot and cold.
Right.
And then they subdivided them into six tastes. And each meal, ideally, should have had a little of each of those six tastes. And that way you would sort of stay in balance.
What were the six tastes?
Pungent, acidic, salty, sweet, astringent, and bitter.
Now, you build the book around a selection of dishes, and each dish illustrates the influence, a major influence that has shaped the food of India. I'd like to talk about vindaloo, because this was the first time we saw influence from Europe.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, that's the first time the European settlers really come and stay in the land and develop real interaction with Indian food. The Portuguese arrive looking for black pepper, and ironically what they do is they bring with them chilies, which eventually replace black pepper more or less in India, in Indian cookery. So it's kind of an ironic twist there.
It is. Can you describe the dish vindaloo?
Vindaloo is a kind of a normally pork, although you can make it with duck as well. Curry. It's extremely hot. Many recipes have as many as 20 red chilies in, really pungent. But it shouldn't be so hot that often restaurants make the mistake of just thinking it should be so hot your eyes water.
Yeah.
But it should have a granular texture to the sauce, and it has all kinds of other spices in there as well, cardamom, cinnamon, and so on. And it's marinated in, the meat is marinated in these spices and vinegar and garlic the night before, and then you cook it up and add the chilies and so on.
So was this very much a Portuguese dish that was adapted to the spices that India had, or was it because pork wasn't eaten in India, was it?
That's right. Well, the point is the Portuguese arrive and they loved meat marinated in wine vinegar and garlic. They loved that kind of fruity taste. And they also loved the Indian spices, of course. That's what they came looking for, the black pepper, the cardamoms and so on. So when they got there, they brought this love of the meats with them. And then, of course, added in the Indian spices that were everywhere once they'd arrived. Mm-hmm. And then they thought, well, chilies actually go well here too. And so they grew chilies in the area around Goa where they were based, and they added chilies into the recipe. So it's a kind of mixture of three continents, the Americas, Europe, and India, this recipe. And they added, the problem was as well that they couldn't get vinegar in India, so they had to be inventive, and they made a different kind of vinegar from toddy, which is the sap of palm trees, which the Indians used to brew alcohol, and they turned it into vinegar.
Huh.
So that added another element. So, and then eventually it turns into what we think of as an Indian curry. And in fact, I don't think the Portuguese eat something like vindaloo at all back home.
Now, Goa was an island. It's an island off the coast of southern India. How did the chilies spread? I mean, they did spread, didn't they?
Yeah, what happened is the Portuguese arrived, and they obviously brought these plants. They'd only just discovered them about 30 years previously in the Caribbean, and they must have brought some seeds with them. And the point about chili seeds is they travel very well, and they're very easy to plant. So clearly they started planting them around Goa, and they took off within a few years of them settling there. Now, the Indians are normally resistant to new ingredients,
mm-hmm.
but this is much what they had up until then as hot spices were black pepper and long pepper. And long pepper got moldy quickly and was difficult to grow. And it tasted almost the same as chilies. So they took to chilies like crazy in the south, where they loved hot food. And it wasn't until the Marathas, who were a sort of central Indian group, started to kind of drive up north, and the Mughals, who were the emperors who we've all sort of heard about in the 16th century, were in charge in the north, and the Marathas kept on attacking them, and they'd become sort of soft and indulgent, and it were lying around on their pillows, and the Marathas, with their fiery natures spurred on by the chilies they were eating, took over up north and took the chilies with them.
It occurs to me that the Portuguese also brought something else with them. They brought Christianity, right? Did that have a lot of influence? And also, you talk about something I had never thought about. If you're going to practice Christianity, you need bread for the host. So you
Absolutely.
Need wheat.
Mm. That was a big problem in India. Indians ate breads made from rice powder and ground down rice and unleavened bread. And there wasn't any yeast, but they were, again, inventive. They would brew a sort of fermenting brew from toddy, and they would make leavened bread that way.
Lizzie, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Historian Lizzie Collingham spoke to us from Cambridge, England. She's author of Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Now, you have got to try vindaloo. Lizzie's recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. Going to work with Dad can be a rite of passage. Kids get a chance to step into the adult world, and sometimes they catch on that they're seeing where their dad's passions lie. And sometimes those passions are catching. Chef Charlie Palmer is a star. He's got 9 restaurants, awards, books, hotels, and he's a dad who takes the kids to work. David Welch visited him in Northern California.
Chef Charlie Palmer is convinced that the quaint town of Healdsburg, California is the perfect place to raise his 4 boys. Cortland is 12, Randall 11, and Reed and Eric are his 8-year-old twins. All 4 love spending summer days under the bright California sun. Like most boys their age, they play sports, swim, and fool around outdoors. And the expansive Sonoma Valley they call home gives them ample room to run. But unlike other kids their age, the Palmer boys have taken to another unique summer hobby. They're learning to cook.
Here's the lineup right here, and this is where you usually put together all the dishes.
Cortland is showing me around the kitchen at his dad's world-class restaurant, Dry Creek Kitchen. It's filled with stainless steel tables, huge mixers, ovens, burners, chicken stock, veal stock, and every other kind of stock you can imagine. Men and women in white coats are hard at work, chopping, dicing, peeling, and at first glance, it's not the most obvious place for a 12-year-old boy to spend his summer breaks. But when Dad's a world-class chef, life isn't typical. Interests, influences, they're a little different. And Chef Palmer points out that his kids have always been keenly interested in where Dad works.
Yeah, it was always like, you know, well, why can't I go to work with you, or why can't I come in the kitchen with you?
The 8-year-old twins aren't allowed in the kitchen yet, but when Randall and Cortland were old enough, they started going to work with their dad.
They get to see what dad does and that kind of thing. And plus, I think they like the kind of atmosphere in the kitchen with all the cooks and the different personalities and stuff like that. So.
And who could blame them? Restaurant kitchens are loud, hot, exciting places. They're filled with outrageous tools, gadgets, characters, not to mention all the delicious food to eat. But Palmer didn't want to candy coat his job. He wanted his boys to understand that although dad makes it look easy, working in a kitchen can be tedious and hard work. How did he do this? By having them start as prep cooks.
Kitchen work is hard work. So, you know, there's a little bit of like, I don't know what I got myself into here. But at the same time, they've really embraced it a lot of times. I mean, to say to a kid, hey, you have to peel 100 pounds of potatoes, that's a pretty daunting task.
Oh, yeah, we peel a lot of potatoes, Randall and I. Got a couple cuts from that.
And we go through a lot of Band-Aids. I mean, not that there's never a nick or a cut, you know, there's a lot of Band-Aids involved. I try to keep them away from the real dangerous stuff, but...
Dad keeps Randall and Cortland away from scalding oil and sizzling pans, but he does allow them to get their hands dirty doing prep work. They peel and chop hundreds of pounds of carrots, potatoes, asparagus. They measure out ingredients for pastries. They've learned how to blanch broccoli, tomatoes, Brussels sprouts, and they're pretty good with a knife. For his part, Chef Palmer doesn't push his boys. He's quick to point out that if Randall or Cortland wanted to play baseball or hang out with their friends, that would be just fine with him. And he's adamant that this recent emphasis on going to work with dad isn't meant to influence their career choices later on. But he does point out that going to work with dad has had one very positive influence on his boys.
The more time they spend in the kitchen, the more adventurous they become as eaters. They're willing to try more food because they work with food.
And Randall and Cortland really like learning about food. But more important, they like spending time with their dad. If they aren't playing baseball or hanging out with their friends, Randall and Cortland are usually helping their dad in the garden or in the kitchen. Palmer points out that they're not only really hard workers, they're pretty good cooks, too. For his part, Cortland says helping dad may be hard work, but it's a great way to spend the summer.
Sometimes you get tired after working 6-7 straight hours, but the excitement kind of covers it up.
He loves mopping the floors.
Oh, no, no. That... Yeah, that I don't enjoy, but I guess you have to do it.
It's a comment that makes both Charlie Palmer the chef and Charlie Palmer the dad smile.
David Welch is a writer and public radio producer living in Portland, Oregon. Well, in honor of upcoming Father's Day, we have got a grill recipe for you. Check out my black pepper honey steak on the website, guys. SplendidTable.org. If you hang out at the right bars, you already know that bitters are the newest edge in very upscale cocktails. Growing up in an Italian family that thought that the bitter called Fernet Branca was the only way to end a meal, I learned to hate the stuff. My first taste produced a stream of disgusting sounds known only to 5-year-olds. But most people concurred. I mean, bitters did not fly off of the store shelf. But LA Times food writer and culinary historian Charles Perry has been tracking a revival of the bitter. Charles, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maybe you should explain what bitters are.
Bitters are alcoholic extracts of plants, roots, stems, leaves, and so on, that are bitter to the taste.
Now this is the thing that strikes me as being so curious, because supposedly we're engineered to not want to eat anything that's bitter because in nature poisons are bitter. How did the bitter enter into the world of being appealing?
Well, that was probably a long road, but they are poisons. Plants produce poisons that are generally bitter.
Right.
And so they were useful in medicine. I mean, they could poison microbes for us, too. So some of these bitters really are medicinal.
Ah, okay. So when did they become very popular?
Their golden age was in about 1860 to 1880 as supposed medicines. And this was the very period when the cocktail was being codified. And the original cocktail recipe was some kind of liquor,
right,
sugar, a bitters, and then generally water or sparkling water. Matter of fact, the champagne cocktail is absolutely unchanged from the 19th century.
Huh. So this was a pleasant way of getting your medicine down.
People probably thought that. They probably, maybe they felt a little guilty, or maybe they just wanted to do something for good luck. But they also discovered that the bitter flavors improved cocktails. They made them more interesting.
So, Charles, what does a bitter taste like? What happens in your mouth when you have a bitter?
First, you feel the bitterness. And then there is the aroma, which is very fragrant and kind of elusive. And it really complements a lot of other flavors, particularly sweet flavors.
Hmm. So it sets them off?
It sets them off. Now, ordinarily, you use just a drop or two because this stuff is very strong.
Now, are there kind of rules about what kind of bitters you would use in what kind of drinks?
There aren't rules, but if you look at the 19th century cocktails when they were really into bitters, the ones based on champagne or whiskey tended to use Angostura, and the ones based on vermouth or gin tended to use orange bitters.
Now, are there new bitters on the market at this point? Are people starting to make new versions of them?
Yes, there's a company that's brought out a mint bitters and a peach pit bitters and an orange bitters. A bartender named Gary Regan has also brought out an excellent orange bitters.
So what would you have us try of the new bitters?
Well, Angostura is not something we should rule out. That's that has a wonderful kind of spicy flavor like cloves and so forth. Peychaud's is a classic bitter. It's the bitter of New Orleans, and it's used in various New Orleans cocktails. It has the same bitter base of gentian as Angostura, but its flavor is kind of like, it reminds me of root beer crossed with anise.
Huh.
And then there's a bitters that was long forgotten called orange bitters, which is made out of orange peel. And, of course, orange peel is medicinal. It contains compounds which kill termites, for one thing.
In case you have any termites in your system, you're going to be just safe, right?
Couldn't hurt.
You've got a drink in this article called The Prom Dress. What's this about?
My editor was out having a drink with a friend of hers, and she was having a champagne cocktail, and she said, just keep adding bitters till it's the color of my prom dress. That works out to about half a teaspoon, if I remember. That's an awful bitter drink.
Yeah, that really is. That's enough to make you really feel like you are drinking medicine. Hey, Charles, thank you.
My pleasure.
LA Times food writer Charles Perry's article on bitters appeared in the newspaper January 26, 2006. Try out bitters with Charles' recipe for the prom dress cocktail. It's a classic champagne cocktail. I mean, what could be bad? It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, how do seedless watermelons reproduce? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how do seedless watermelons reproduce?
Well, the poor things really don't. Or they do, but they need a partner. Sound familiar? Anyway, my husband asked this question in mid-slurp as we were eating watermelon the other night. So I hit the Virginia Polytech site, and I found out that seedless watermelons have to be planted alongside a partner, a regular seeded watermelon. Genetic manipulation sort of sterilizes seeds, so in a seedless melon you get soft white specks instead of hard black seeds. And the plants can't produce pollen, the secret of life. So planting seedless next to a regular watermelon that can marry, that is, pollinate, makes both melons ripen. Well, I think seedless melons are nice when you have company, but remember those watermelon seed contests? Who can propel them the furthest? You can't do that with a sissy seedless melon. Time for your call, so pick up that phone. Number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. We have got Ann from Clawson, Michigan. Hey, Ann, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have inherited a set of copper pots from my grandparents. They're kind of nesting, but it looks like there might be two sets. There's three smallish ones
right. That
seem to have a coating on them and two larger ones that don't.
Uh-huh.
And I use them just like regular mixing bowls, but some of the things react with them.
Oh, like yeah.
I did roll batter overnight and had some green stuff on the roll batter in the morning. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wondering what the do's and don'ts are.
So you're using them not to cook, but using them as utensils to mix things in?
Pretty much.
Okay. The only thing you want to have use copper for is if you're preserving. I'm talking about unlined, you know, raw, just pure copper. If you're preserving and you're cooking in a lot of sugar. You know, the making jam, for instance, okay. Where you're using a great deal of sugar. Otherwise, it reacts with most foods, and it can be toxic.
Okay.
And I don't think you want to use it. The green is a real sure sign. But I know what you're, you know, I mean, your instinct is you look at these beautiful pots and you say, I don't want to let them go to waste, and you want to use them. The thing is that the copper reacts with a lot of stuff. Anything that's acidic, it reacts with eggs, and you just need to line it. Now, on the website, we've got some names of companies that do reline copper pots. You know, they retin them. You have to send them away to do it, and it's not inexpensive. But if they're thick copper and they've got iron handles, these are treasures. These are great pots, and you may want to, you know, invest in them because they're fabulous. And you can get them, you know, they're lined normally in tin, which is kind of soft. It does wear, but it takes a long time for a tin lining to wear off.
So if they were lined, I could use them just as
you
regular?
You could use them as cooking, you know, as cooking pots. And you just, ideally, you don't use anything that's going to scratch them in them. So you'd use wooden implements. But, yeah, you will love cooking with copper. But don't invest unless they're really good, thick copper with the iron handles. Because the thinner copper that has the brass handles, the handles get forbiddingly hot. And you can really burn yourself. And generally, that thin copper doesn't cook any better than, you know, let's say a good stainless steel pan with a thick aluminum base. It's pretty, but it's not anything that you'd write home about. But the thicker stuff, it just responds to the heat. You know, it's like the Lance Armstrong of pots. It just flies. I mean, when that heat hits it, it picks it up instantly. When you take it off the heat, it loses it quickly. And this is why chefs love it, because when you're doing fast sautés or you want to just stop something from cooking with a copper pot, it tends to be more sensitive than most other metals.
Would copper bowls be any different, or would that be?
Well, copper bowls, same thing. Copper bowls, egg whites in copper bowls, fine. In fact, the copper helps the egg white stabilize. But generally, you don't do anything else in a copper bowl. The idea is never should unlined copper be exposed to food.
Okay.
That's the basic. I hate to tell you this because it sounds like
did.
A great treasure. But don't throw them out under any circumstances. They would be beautiful hung in the kitchen. You know, they're just, old copper pots are just glorious.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hey, you're welcome.
Bye.
Take care. I hate to disappoint her. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Heather calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Heather, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk to you about a wedding cake.
Ooh.
My fiancé and I are getting married next month, and we're both musicians in the Grand Rapids Symphony, so we appreciate things that are creative and unusual.
Right.
So the cake that we're looking for is a jade cake, and we can't quite decide what jade would taste like.
Now, wait a minute. Are you talking about a cake actually prepared with ground jade?
No, but it would be the same color as jade, and we would like it to taste like what jade would taste like.
Well, jade, I've actually sucked jade. I know this is weird. I will try anything once. Jade doesn't really have much of a flavor. But in the spirit of the areas of the world we associate jade with,
yes,
green tea.
Right. Now, we thought about that, and we thought about jasmine.
Well, I'm not thinking of straight green tea.
Oh.
I mean, you know, yes, you could do any recipe that uses jasmine tea. You could use a really flavorful, like a, I don't know, Essentia. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Essencha green tea. There are so many green teas out there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what a wonderful excuse. Both you and your fiancé can taste your way through some. I mean, green teas can be very delicate. They can be very boastful, but they are, some of them are really distinctive, and they would come through in a cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in Japan, they make cakes with green tea. They tend to be sort of a cross between a, in texture I'm talking about, kind of a butter sponge and a pound cake.
Okay.
And they're made, there's a kind of cake that the French call a genoise, where you whip eggs.
Right.
Maybe you're familiar with it, where the leavening, there is some leavening in them, but essentially the leavening is the whipped eggs, and then you fold in melted fat and you fold in flour, but you whip the eggs and the sugar together.
Right.
And that's the basic method of making at least the Japanese green tea cake that I'm familiar with. So jade, and by the way, sticking a little green food coloring in it would not harm it.
Right. The other idea that we had, what do you think about pistachio? Would that taste like jade?
Well, it wouldn't taste like jade, but it would taste great. Now, pistachio is fabulous, but one of the tricks with pistachio is use salted ones because you get more flavor.
Okay.
And you can buy them shelled and salted.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another trick with pistachio that's really kind of interesting. Like if you want to do, I'm trying to think, a frosting that with it or whatever.
Right.
There is an almond syrup. You'll find it often in espresso shops. It's, the French name for it is orgeat, O-R-G-E-A-T. And it's like a white syrup. And it's made from almond. And the reality is, if you smell it and you taste it with a few pistachios, you could swear it's pistachio.
Wow.
And the thing is that a little bit of that, you know, worked into the frosting along with something like chopped or ground pistachio.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the cake itself is more neutral,
okay,
but the filling is something like ground pistachio that has been mixed with a sugar syrup or with this orgeat.
Oh.
You know, and it could be in a base of a buttercream. It could be in the base of a meringue.
Right.
But you see what I'm saying? I mean, you could end up with this intense experience of pistachio.
Right.
And you could call it the jade gilded cake.
Ooh.
And, you know, it's even, you know, this is the whole idea of marketing. You give it a great name and it goes so far. I mean, I love the idea of a wedding cake that just isn't like every other wedding cake.
Yes, exactly.
And I think, you know, the idea of a jade cake is great. But the wonderful thing about it is you can make it almost anything you want it to be.
Right, exactly.
And pistachios. Oh, pistachios are so beautiful. Now, you're getting married next month. I'm just thinking about, I mean, is there fruit decorating this cake? Like, do you have scatterings of caramelized pistachios so they glint in sugar syrup that's hardened, and they're scattered with strawberries or raspberries, that green and red, you know, on something like a pale, pale green pistachio frosting. Couldn't you see that?
I really could.
I mean, I think that would really be beautiful.
It would.
And it's your jade gilt cake. I mean, you could have a little gold leaf here and there, too.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
Well, you know, in India, from what I understand, the gold leaf is used for celebratory gatherings and weddings included.
Right.
And gold leaf just dropped on the cake here and there, you know, tuck it in to the frosting here and there just to anchor it. It would be beautiful.
That would be really nice.
Hey, why don't we start a catering business,
yeah,
Heather? You know,
we'll call it jade cakes.
We could call it jade cakes, you know. But we could just design them. Have somebody else make them, but just design them. Heather, I hope I've helped because I've taken you down a completely different path, but I think it could be an exciting cake.
That's really wonderful ideas. Thank you so much.
Hey, and congratulations to the two of you.
Well, thank you.
I want to hear about this wedding.
You know, I will. I will let you know what we do with it.
If you could send pictures of the cake, we'd love it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we'd love it.
Let's do that.
Hey, you take care.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
I love the idea of playing around with the cake. And, you know, don't forget this gold gilt business, guys. I mean, you can anchor gilding to buttercream beautifully. And it's just, you know, scatterings of it, whispers of it, little shreds and tatters of it on a cake. It doesn't even have to be a wedding cake. It can be a cake you serve Saturday night or whenever. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Nancy calling from St. Louis. Nancy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm calling to see if you have an easy recipe for tamales. And by easy, I mean not having to go to five specialty stores looking for ingredients. And number two, not spending all day in the kitchen either cooking or washing dishes.
Oh, you know, I have to say my first reaction is, and I don't mean to be difficult, but a good tamale has, I have never had a shortcut tamale that I've loved. Let's put it that way. But that said, there's so many parts of it that you can do ahead. The filling, whatever you decide the filling is going to be, you know, it could be spiced pork, it could be chicken that you've done, you know, with chilies and pumpkin seed. It could be something, you know, it could be something as simple as a salsa that you mix with cheese or with, you know, cooked meat or chicken or fish. It could be that easy.
The pumpkin seed sounds awful good.
Oh, you know, it's a great Mexican recipe of chicken and a pumpkin, green pumpkin seed sauce, and I think it's done with green chilies.
Mm-hmm.
The real key to a tamale is the masa, the corn mixture, that dough that you line the tamale with, the corn husk with, that encloses your filling is called masa. You probably know this. And it's made from hominy. And hominy is corn that has been soaked essentially in a lye mixture, dried corn kernels that are reconstituted in and cooked a little bit in a lye mixture. And that sort of releases the skin around the corn, and it gives it that special flavor that you get from a taco chip, for instance. And that is if you can get fresh-made masa, which a lot of grocery stores carry. Now, you're in St. Louis, right?
Right.
There has to be some stores that specialize in Latino, Mexican, New Mexican, Tex-Mex, that kind of thing food.
I hope so. I'm originally from Texas, and I just haven't found anything to rival a Texas tamale.
You're spoiled, girl.
I am spoiled.
Oh, you're spoiled. But I think if you check, you're going to be able to find it.
Okay.
And you know, I mean, if you just get the masa, you have to ask them if the lard's already in it. You want to put lard in it, and good lard. Or I know it sounds like a sacrilege, people to have put butter or olive oil.
Ooh,
into
that
muscle.
Sounds good.
It's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. But the idea is that you soak two, you know, every tamale takes two of the corn husks. You soak those corn husks about 30 minutes in water. And then what you do is you essentially pat in a thin coat of that masa. And you want to just run down the center of that rectangle that you've patted in some of that filling. And then you wrap. And you wrap the tamale in a way that the masa surrounds the filling.
Okay.
And you then fold it. You fold up the corn husk. You can tie it. You can take a little strip of another corn husk and actually use it as a tie. And then, of course, you steam them. And you steam them for about an hour.
Okay.
Now, by the way, two authors that will give you foolproof advice and have you make tamales you will die for. One is Rick Bayless.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a whole bunch of recipes. I know one of his books is Mexico One Plate at a Time. He's on PBS. Mexico One Plate at a Time, great tamale recipes. And then the authority to end all authorities is Diana Kennedy.
Diana Kennedy.
Yeah, anything that she writes, she's the kind of person that people follow her and kiss the hem of her apron. You know, these are not fast, but these are things you can do in stages so that you can pull it together fairly quickly.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? Because you know what best tastes like. Don't let yourself have anything less.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome, Nancy. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Catering for the stars. Sounds like a dream job, but is it? Frank Woodward's company is Four Stars Catering. Now, he's fed movie companies all over the world, including the Mission Impossible 3 gang. Well, I've got Frank on the phone. Frank, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be with you.
Are you in recovery at this point?
Actually, I'm through that. I'm actually back into the working mode again.
So you're on another film?
Yes. We're on Evan Almighty.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at this Mission Impossible cast. We've got Tom Cruise, Carrie Russell, Ving Rhames, Lawrence Fishburne. We are talking here major bodies. I mean, forget the talent. I mean, these people have to be on all kinds of specialized regimes. Was this the case?
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of times people don't realize that when you're on a movie as an actor, mm-hmm. and they shoot the outside scene on May 1st, they may not shoot the inside scene until June 31st. So you've got to look the same. You've got to weigh the same. Your haircut's got to be the same. And so they particularly have to be a weight and stay exactly the same. They can't gain 3 or 4 pounds. So eat a lot of protein and very low fat.
Yeah, I was thinking you must be the past master of, you know, great-tasting, low-cal and healthy food and all that business.
We try. You know, it's, I mean, sometimes they get stuck on a chicken breast, and after about 112 ways of doing that, you can't run out.
So you're doing 3 meals a day on a movie set, and you're feeding stars with all these demands. How many people are you feeding totally when you generally work a movie?
Well, at night they give you a call of how many meals they want the next day, and today the call was for 307, so I'll probably feed somewhere around 320, 325 people. A walk in the park.
But now, I've heard tell that part of Mission Impossible 3 was shot in China and that you had to pull off a Thanksgiving dinner. How did you pull this off?
Well, yeah, the whole thing came about Paula Wagner, who's a producer, partner with Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. She said to me, just kind of in a nonchalant thing, you know, Frank, we're going to be in China on Thanksgiving. It would be great if you could get the crew a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. And I said, yeah, absolutely, no problem. Wow, was I wrong. We get to China, and they don't have turkeys. They do actually have a turkey, but it's a pretty small little thing, about a 7-pounder, uh-huh. real little, doesn't look much like a turkey. And I ended up getting American frozen turkeys through Singapore and shipped into Shanghai. And it worked lovely, except the kitchen caught on fire and a couple of other problems.
You're kidding!
We ended up doing it. No. They rented me a kitchen in one of the major hotels, and it had a big charbroiler.
Uh-huh.
And so we were down there at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the chef was loading it with charcoal. And I said to him, I said, you know, and through an interpreter, I said, you know, in America, that would be way too much charcoal. And no, he answered me back through the interpreter that he knew what he was doing, and this was going to be fine. So I left, and I left my wife and my chef, and we went out to do breakfast, and they were going to cook the turkeys and everything. About an hour and a half later, they call me. My wife says, Frank, the kitchen's on fire, everything. The sprinkler systems were on, everything turned on, so we literally had to bone the turkeys and cook them that way. So,
Oh boy.
It was an exciting Thanksgiving.
But nobody knew it,
and everybody loved it.
Hey, Frank, thanks for talking with us.
Lynn, my pleasure.
You take care.
Thank you.
Frank Woodward is owner and chef of Four Stars Catering in Hollywood. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this poem from Charles Simic. It's called Watermelons. Green Buddhas on the fruit stand. We eat the smile and spit out the teeth. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. And by the way, you can now take us with you. Simply download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. We love to travel, so check out the site for details. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.